Good afternoon. So I'm going to do exam review. The way that's going to work is I'm going to take your things you want me to talk about. I'm going to get a list of those. Then we're going to go through them. If we finish that, I'll get a second list. If you don't give me anything to talk about, we'll leave early. So what would you like me to talk about here? Yes.
Read or write along.
Okay. Anything more specific?
Kind of like a, I think more of a high level, not too
okay.
Can you go over system calls versus context switches?
Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Can you do converting from a virtual address to a
digital
address?
Okay. Types of what, sorry? Scheduling? Okay. Just generally? Okay. Scheduling types. Okay. Okay. Anything else?
Maybe go through a problem on how to schedule some events to minimize turnaround time.
Okay. Okay. More. Yeah.
Do you know we're setting up process page tables with exec?
So setting up.
Sorry.
Yeah, page setting up page tables. Okay. Work exec. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So first question was system calls versus context switches. So I think the confusion here is because in OS, in XP6 and similar OS designs, context switches only occur within kernel mode. So before a context switch, always enter kernel mode, could be via a system call, could be via something else, timer interrupt IO, etc. Since we always enter before, maybe I can make this a little bigger. Before and after a context switch, just usually leave kernel mode, not guaranteed, and go back to application. So I think that's where the confusion comes in. So a system call is just one of the ways that the kernel does things. And it happens that entering the kernel is a prerequisite to doing a context switch, because only the kernel has access to the things you need to do a context switch, like information from the other program, because we don't allow programs to just access that directly. Kernel mode, needs access, needs to change kernel data structures, needs to access other programs' data, which can't be done by user code, since so they can't mess things up. So I think that's where that confusion comes in. So some system calls might trigger a context switch, but that's just part of what service the system call is requesting, e.g. read, wait for input implies switch to another program until there is more input. Like, it's just part of the service the system call is providing. It's not because system calls have an inherent relationship to context switches. Okay, so the user and kernel saturating a context switch. So in XV6 and similar OS designs, we do two we don't decide whether we're doing a context switch until we enter the kernel. And we have generic trap, exception, interrupt, system call, handling code that saves user registers. And this is used regardless, and this is used if we just want to run some kernel code using the same registers. So like when we just have a system call, for example, we want to use the registers that we usually use, like EAX. We save those, so e.g. system call handler will use EAX, ESP, etc. Stack pointer, etc. Need to remember what their old values were, just like for a function call, like function call saving registers. So like if you think of a function call, you save registers for a function call and restore them afterwards. Same sort of idea applies to running anything in the kernel. So this is generic in the sense that happens to save user registers before we decide to do a context switch. So no need to have extra code to handle them, because we always decide to do a context switch after we enter the kernel and done this register saving. There's no need for extra special case code for saving user registers. So now for the context switch in the kernel still need to save the kernel registers. And this is what we saw, XV6, the switch function, does this to the kernel stack and reads the new ones from a different kernel stack. Just because we needed to save those somewhere and they haven't been saved yet. The user register is already saved. And our generic trap handling code happens to save the user register saved to kernel stack. Just because it runs on the kernel stack, we don't want to mess with the user stack, so that's where they've chosen to save those. Like this is the decision XV6 made about where to save things. Like you could imagine deciding to save things elsewhere. But this design is pretty typical, because you need a stack when you're running in the kernel anyways. You probably want one for every process because you want to switch away and remember where you are in a system call. That's a natural way of doing it. So does that answer people's questions about user and kernel stack? I guess I didn't mention the user stack, so. Yes, and one of those registers points to user stack. That's where the user stack gets involved in this process. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Where is switch called from?
This is the context switch in the kernel. So this is the low-level function which you've seen typically used to switch to the scheduler, and from the scheduler to a program. Does that answer your question?
So is it called from trap?
Indirectly. Okay. So typical usage of switch is called from the scheduler, called from a utility function that just switches to the scheduler. Like, this is what happens internally, and a context switch, what we call a context switch, XV6 context switch, probably, you know, switch to scheduler, then from scheduler to other. Like, that's usually what we think of as a context switch in XV6, which we kind of glossed over when we started explaining context switches. Other questions? Yes?
Can you go over what else is on the kernel stack?
The question is, what else is on the kernel stack? So kernel stack is just where temporary variables used by code running in the kernel is. In the kernel, and saved registers, return addresses, etc. Everything you learned about being on the stack for a normal program, but just for the code. Also, code running in the kernel. So not the user code. Is that answer your question? Other questions on user and kernel stack? Okay, so then scheduler types is not internal. So let me pull up, where did I put that in the slide I want to use for this? Use the this, yeah. Right here, so. Want a. So. Okay, I thought I put it in there, but apparently I put it in the next day. Okay, so right, this slide. So at some point, showed this slide. So this is sort of summary of scheduler, so I'll just type that up. Assuming I can figure out. Okay, so let's get, so we have your throughput, first come, first served. This is, you know, simplest scheduler of doesn't context switch unless needed. Response time, so we mean like turnaround average per process, per thread, I should say, turnaround or waiting time is SRTF. So one question was, how do I minimize turnaround time? SRTF minimizes turnaround time. There may be other schedules which aren't SRTF which have the same turnaround time, but SRTF always minimizes it under the assumptions about, minimum SRTF, under assumptions that context switch overhead isn't significant. So that's how you minimize turnaround time, SRTF. That tells you what the minimum turnaround time is. There might be some things you can do which don't change the turnaround time, but it does minimize it. Yes, your question? Yeah, so throughput equals work per unit time. And we mentioned on this slide, I/O throughput approximately something like SRTF. This is, make sure programs get to do their I/O operations quickly. And SRTF approximately does that. I'm saying something like it because, actually, we didn't talk about actually minimizing that or maximizing that. So intuition about, remember the intuition about SRTF we had is race to sleep, that we want to like run the things that will start sleeping as soon as possible. That's why you might think of it's good for making sure IO happens quickly. And we mentioned fairness in the medium term was CFS, so the completely fair scheduler. So that the idea is that this took into account recent CPU usage, tried to benefit with this virtual time concept, tried to run program most deprived of recent CPU usage. So that was what CFS did. So it's, you know, medium term, you know, recent-ish, but not like instantaneous. Yeah, not like, so it wasn't fair in the way that lottery might have been fair in that everything has an equal chance to run, but it's trying to equalize CPU usage over some not super short term. This is for wait time, so something round robin or similar. You know, everything gets to run, you know, at equal intervals. You know, everything will get to run, get to start running same amount of time because we scan through all programs. So round robin is fair in a different sense. Like round robin says, no matter what's happened in the past, I'm going to run you in about the same amount of time because I'm going to run everyone in about the same amount of time. Yeah. So I think everyone runs periodically with roughly the same interval. So it's like fair in terms of how long you wait to run. Yeah, time until you run. Yeah.
Is it a completely fair schedule? What do you mean by medium term?
So what I mean by medium term, so like order, you know, maybe hundreds, you know, tenths of seconds to tenths of seconds. It depends on parameters. Exactly like what time length it's going over, but not like hours and not like microseconds. Like it doesn't try to, like it doesn't want to context switch every microsecond, so it's not going to do that. You know, so not like milliseconds, microseconds, doesn't want to context switch, doesn't try to context switch that much. Not like context switch that much, and tries to take into account more history. So something, you know, we care about more than the last millisecond, and not like minutes, second, you know, minutes, hours, you know, doesn't, you know, want to penalize programs based on what they were doing a whole minute ago, what they were doing that long ago. You know, so you don't get penalized in CFS because you used a lot of CPU an hour ago. So that's not something we want. But you also don't, like, we do take into account that you had some amount of time ago on the order of hundreds of milliseconds or seconds. That's what I mean by medium term. Does that answer your question? Okay. So yeah, round robin, like, tries to run everything periodically, so that's sort of notion of fair, and that was our simplest preemptive scheduler. Because we like didn't make any hard decisions about what to run. We just did the easiest thing, which is take the next thing on the list. And as my old slide has, so real world deadlines, you know, we mentioned earliest deadline first or mark, which we didn't go over much this semester, and favoring certain users, we had a priority. And I guess here and can't. So those were the sort of scheduler types we gave. And within these types, we had some specialization. So for SRTF, you know, can't actually implement SRTF. So use approximations like MLFQ, multi-level feedback queues. It's an approximation of SRTF because we can't really implement SRTF. Yeah.
Can you get it on these two screens?
It tells me it's on both of the screens, so that is interesting. Oh, they're turned off. Oh, you can turn off the screens. That's cute. We're both on? Okay. It says powering off here, so. And I can't see, so. That better? Good. Okay. So now we're actually showing on all the screens. Okay. So hopefully that's easier for you to see back there. So that's sort of a high level, very high level, what are the schedulers based on goal, which I think is a useful way to categorize, like, examples that meet each goal. And yeah, the caveat that for SRTF, we can't implement it, so we talked a bunch about how do we approximate it, given that we can't really implement it. Okay, favoring certain users' priority, and I guess I would mention as a high level other goals, you know, we might need to invent a different scheduler, you know, a new scheduler probably built from priority or lottery or similar. Like when we built schedulers, we generally say, oh, we know how to do priority scheduling, so let's use our priority scheduling idea and set the priorities in a particular way, or let's use a lottery scheduling idea and set the amount of tickets in a particular way, and that's a way we can accomplish other scheduling goals. And we can think of CFS as like, it's using a priority scheduler where the priority is virtual time. So with a few modifications, with that sort of how we start building schedulers if we don't have one that works for the goal we want. Okay, so anything about schedulers I missed that I should talk about? Okay. So, reader-writer locks. So, for many data structures, we have this property that we can safely read the data structure from many threads at once, but only if no thread is trying to modify it. And, you know, to make sure that this property holds, so how can we guarantee that the but only if part? So one way is use locks before reading or writing the data structure, reading or writing. But if we do this, then we have to take turns reading. So this is correct, won't violate the safety rule, but slow. So reader-writer locks are a solution to this problem. So reader-writer locks could use locks. Yeah, so writer locks try to, you know, solve this taking turns problem by extending a lock to have two sort of ways of being locked. We have read lock allows any read lock registers a thread as a reader, and write lock registers a thread as a writer. And with normal locks, we would wait until there are no other threads trying to use the data structure. Like, but now we're going to wait until no writers, instead of just no other threads. Versus normal lock, wait until no other threads. No other threads whatsoever. And for write lock, we're going to wait until no readers and writers, which is the same as normal lock. Yeah. Same as normal lock. Normal lock, it turns out. Okay. And, you know, by having less restrictive conditions for waiting, can do more things at once. You know, we don't take turns reading anymore. So that's the high-level idea of reader-writer locks. And sort of, we had some talk about implementation note. So when implementing reader-writer locks, you know, need to make a decision about what to do if a reader and a writer is waiting, you know, who goes first? Waiting and could go. You know, reader, writer is waiting, who goes first? So we need to make a decision about that, and there's, you know, like we could make, and we can make decisions that are kind of in between, but we should make some sort of decision, or if we don't explicitly make a decision, you know, our implementation's gonna decide something, and that may or may not be good. So, is there something about reader-writer locks that whoever asked about this was looking for that I haven't covered? Okay, so then monitors. So, monitors are sort of, we can think of as a way of building data structures that wait for things to happen sometimes. So we have some shared data, which tracks lock plus shared data plus condition variables. So the lock means that we always take turns accessing shared data. So don't have to worry about being confused about about the state of that. So example, if the shared data is reader-writer locks, we don't have to be confused about, e.g., shared data is for view lock, not confused about whether there are zero or one threads waiting to write. We would know, we'll have one answer because we're taking turns looking at the stored data about that. State of data and the shared data. So the shared data, can include whatever data we're manipulating, like a queue of work to do, can include information about who's waiting, so we can enforce conditions about when to wait. Okay. So then we have condition variables, and our usage is one condition variable for everything we wait for, and while we still need to wait, and this we still need to wait is, this is based on the shared data. So we need to have the shared data track enough information that we can know that. Wait, cond wait on some CV. Shared data, and this means shared data. Data has to include bookkeeping info needed to know when we wait. So that's sort of a key thing, that we have this shared data and we can track whether we need to wait in there, and we have to do that to use condition variables properly. So while we still need to wait, we wait on a condition variable, and if some thread might no longer need to wait, whenever we change whether con signal or con broadcast, be, and there's an extra And somewhere else, we need to like say, oh, if they might no longer need to wait, if that condition, we might have changed that condition to no longer be true, we need to signal or broadcast depending on the circumstance. So we saw the example of using monitors for implement reader-writer locks. So the data structure that we were tracking was like the information about who's waiting, which we tracked just with some counters. And that was our shared data. It included information not just about who was reading and writing, but also about who was waiting to read and write, when we wanted to implement particular policies about when to wait. And once we wrote down, well, we still need to wait, we had a condition variable for each reason we needed to wait, and add code, which when we changed those conditions, like when we changed the number of readers, we signaled someone who might be affected by that change, or broadcast to someone who might be affected by that change. So that's high level on monitors. Some details, details that we need to go over, questions, yeah. So why do spurious wakeups occur? Okay, so spurious wakeups. So POSIX allows spurious wakeups just to make, so I should define these first. So equals cond wait returns when nothing happens to make implementing CVs easier. And probably happen mostly when one CV is manipulated in parallel from two threads. Two threads, but I don't know that for sure. I suspect like it's mainly that basically the reason POSIX, my guess, I'm not sure, but my guess is that POSIX is saying that, hey, I know you might want to, like, you could implement like signal so it always wakes up exactly one thread, but you know that might be hard to do quickly, so instead why don't you do something which sometimes might wake up two threads because you have a race condition in there, but that might be safe. We'll say that that's allowed, you know, like, so just for convenience, and I suspect it mostly comes up if you have things happening in parallel, or like if two threads broadcast, maybe something weird happens with people waiting afterwards, you know. That sort of thing might be allowed just for convenience. And sort of a justification why, this is not a big problem with POSIX design, like you might say, you know, is this really worth it? Is that usually you have to worry about, without spurious wakeups, some thread acquiring the lock in between when you wake up from waiting and when you get the lock again. So for example, if thread A is calling consume, thread A waiting in consume for another item on queue, woken up via signal from thread B. Thread C gets lock, thread C dequeues, thread A shouldn't dequeue, even though it was woken up. Thread C unlocks. Woken up. So what could happen is thread A wakes up, and in between the time it wakes up and when it gets the lock, some thread C sneaks in, dequeues something. So this sort of scenario is not every problem using monitors has this scenario. So not every monitor using code has this sort of scenario, but it's usually a reason why you can't avoid the while loop anyways. So usually this sort of scenario means that because that threads can sneak in even though you got signaled, usually you can't avoid the while loop. And would not be possible. This scenario would not be possible with Hoare scheduling, but no one implements that. So remember, Hoare scheduling, hand off the lock, hand off mutex on signal. poor scheduling is when you signal, we give you the mutex next guaranteed, but that's not what anyone does, unfortunately. Almost anyone. So that answer question. Yeah.
So does the conditional wait only try to give up the lock if it has it?
So the question is, does the conditional wait only try to give up the lock if it has it? No, it is an error to call conditional wait if you do not have the lock that you passed to conditional wait.
So the spurious wake-up does still acquire the lock?
Yes, so the spurious wake-up will still acquire the lock, yes. It's confusion about whether to wake up or not, not about whether the lock, who has the lock. So, yeah, back there.
So signal
is guarantee that only one thread cares. E.g., if I signal for each item I add to a queue, at most one thread cares about each one, so it's safe. E.g., for a reader-writer lock, only one writer is allowed at a time, so I can signal a writer rather than broadcasting. And broadcast otherwise. So if you don't know only one thread cares, you should broadcast just in case you needed two threads to do something. And I guess a subtlety about this is that you should, when you're thinking about whether to signal or broadcast, you should remember that the thing you signal might not run next. Yeah. So, considering, remember what you signal might not run next. E.g., so where this comes up is that, like, if you're saying while queue is full, so e.g., typically wrong to signal when, you know, queue has a particular size because you might have a scenario where, like, thread A add to queue, signal, queue size equals K, signal B, and then we might have C, wait, and we're going to have I'll do thread. Oh. Thread C. And so wait. Thread C and D. So let's say we have thread C and D waiting, and lock. So I guess we'll say thread B add to queue. So, like, if you're expecting to signal when you add to a queue and make it a certain size, like, the problem is that you can have two threads sneak in and do that, and don't assume that because you signaled, you traded off there. Like, this is a scenario, runs, but thread D is still waiting because, you set it to a certain size, but... your intuition might have been, oh, we had someone waiting to make the queue go down to size K from K plus 1, but that's not what's going to happen. Sorry, that isn't a super clear example, but the idea is that, like, if you're signaling on a threshold, your idea of when that threshold is met might not match what actually happens because things don't happen. Just because you signal something doesn't mean it has to run right away. So if your expectation was that if people are waiting while the queue size is K, they get to run as things get added, that's not what's going to happen because things can sneak in. Because things more than K things can be added. But you'd be fine if you signal each time. So, not what you'd expect if you thought that, you know, while Q size is K, and waiting, let them handle the item right away. You know, that's not going to work that way. That's not a great example because it has the greater than K. There's examples where this, yes, remove, where this sort of thing would work differently. But like the important thing is remember what you signal might not come next when considering what happens. So like in this scenario, you should remember, yes, it's possible that the Q can get greater than K, even though we're signaling every time we add when it goes above K. Every time we add when it gets to K, rather. Yeah, and things were waiting all the time. Like that's, you know, not going to be prevented. Okay, so I'd like to know where I am on time. Okay. So other questions on that? Yeah. For handing off a mutex, I mean, like, you know, so handoff mutex equals guarantee what is signaled gets locked next. So, like, our intuition, like the scenario is going over here, is that you'd expect, we signaled C here. We expect C to run right away, but that's not what happens because C wakes up, but doesn't get the lock right away. And so that's something you need to consider both for why you need that while loop, because typically that's going to mess up with your condition. And when you think about whether the signal or broadcast, you should need to remember that just because you signaled something doesn't mean it gets to run right away. So you have to consider, what if more things come in that aren't the thing I just signaled? No. So in this case, like even though it might seem like in your program impossible for the Q size to get greater than K, it's absolutely possible. Okay, other questions? Okay, so virtual to physical address translation. So our first step in this process is to split the virtual address into pieces. So we have our virtual address, and it has a virtual page number part and a page, I'll make that bigger for later, and a page offset part. And the page offset, this is enough to identify which byte of a page. So if page size equals 2 to the 12 bytes, 12 bits, for example. Then we have our virtual page number, and maybe everything left over, and that's going to be split up into parts. So I'll have label this as part 1. Two, and we'll say VPM part 1. This is, make that clear, enough to index into the first level page table, which is an array of page table entries. So, if 1024, that's 2 to the 10 entries in the first level page table, applies 10 bits, because that's what we need to get indexed into that array. And VP in part two is the same, except for the second level page table. And we could have more parts if we had more levels. So in this example, I'll just do two. So step two is look up a page table entry in the first level. So use the page table base pointer as the beginning, which is equal to the beginning of array of first level PTEs, and access that array VPN part one, index VPN part one to that array. So that array plus VPN part one times the size of a first level PTE, just because that's how array accesses work. And the first level PTE will contain a valid bit, if not set, valid slash present bit. If not set, then stop. Done. Don't look at the other steps. Metadata bits, readable, writable, etc. Stop if program not allowed to do access, and a physical page number. Okay. So that's our step two. So we got our first level page table entry. So then we use the first level page table entry to look up second level. So this is the same as step three. So this is the same as step two, but use the physical page number we found in step two converted to a byte address as the page table base pointer. And use VPN part two instead of VPN part one. So converting the physical page number, this is so we can say add zeros to fill in page offset or multiply by the page size. Both are equivalent. You can think of this as a unit conversion, pages to bytes, right? The addresses we want are in bytes, but the page number is an address in pages, so we're just doing a unit conversion. Okay. Questions? Step. So step four, use the second level variable entry to get the PA. So find address from, find physical page number. I said add zeros to fill in the page offset. I mean concatenate with zeros, just to be clear, because adding zeros doesn't do very much for talking about addition. Step four, so we use the physical page number from the second level entry, combine with the page offset from the original virtual address. The result is the final physical address. And by combine, I mean concatenate. Okay, so questions about that procedure? Yeah. So the question is, will the first level page will use the same offset?
Yeah.
So in step two, we're converting that physical page number just to a base address. And that's the beginning of the page. Converted to I guess I should say, the byte address of the beginning of that page. So we're going to the beginning of that page. That's where the page table is. We don't care about the page offset yet because we aren't to that step. Like, it's only at the last step do we use the page offset from the virtual address. So one way of remembering this is that, like, our address, you know, when we divide it into all the pieces, we have VPN part one, VPN part two, page offset. We use VPN part one in the first part, then VPN part two, then page offset. So you shouldn't be touching the page offset until you've used everything else. Other questions? Okay, so the next thing was on setting up page tables for exec. So this is what XV6 does. Other OSs might differ. So we have, So we have some constraints. So we need to set up the kernel part of the page tables. So every process, and this is true in most OSs, has a kernel region. Has kernel memory as part of its page table, set with metadata, so it will only work in kernel mode. This is, avoid changing page tables to let kernel handle exceptions, system calls, etc. We don't want to change the page table pointer all the time, so we just put the kernel in every page table so we don't have to do that. Since the kernel needs to run a lot, we just make so it doesn't matter what's running right now, it's there. So that means we need to set that up. And we also need to allocate memory for the program's data, for code and data. And we need to copy from disk into that allocated memory. So those are our basic steps. And as far as how we implement these, so for setting up the kernel part, we just have a hard-coded list of, VA, PA, essentially, of page table entry ranges to set up. We don't actually store each page table in our hard-coded list, but we store the ranges and just generate them with the for loop, basically. Generate page table entries with a for loop, for loops. So that's basically what we're doing there for that. For allocating memory for the code or data, we need to read from the executable information about should the program be loaded and how much. And then set up that much space, again, basically with a for loop. And then copy from disk, read from executable information about where to load data from on disk. So that's just part of the executable is like a table of that information. Okay. And for setting individual page table entries in XV6, they use the same kind of procedure we did for VA to PA, but stop when they figure out where the second level page table entry would be. And then change the second level PTE. And if they're stopped earlier, they might change. Stopped at the first level PTE, they'll change that first. For pagers. That's basic. So walk pager is doing the find the second level PTE, possibly fill in the first level. And once we find the second level, we fill that in. That's basically what those for loop is doing for each page we want to set up. So questions? Have a lot of time. Yeah.
Do you go over the shared bus for like multiple cores?
Bus. Gosh, like anything more specific? Like.
Just kind of. I guess like how the snooping works and like what kind of sets something to invalid shared and modified.
Okay. Gosh, any other topics in our last 15 minutes? Yeah.
Have you talked about how memory is allocated in the previous class? Or just like that?
Like how do we allocate physical pages?
In setting up the page tables using exec.
Okay, so how memory is allocated for what?
I guess how the OS handles communicating with hardware to know where the mapping is for the page table.
Okay, so let's talk about allocating memory and the hardware. So XV6's strategy is that XV6 like learns on boot, in XV6 case by a hard coded real OS some table in the hardware, how much memory there is. And track has a data structure that tracks which parts of that XV6 is not using. And uses that data structure to find memory it can use for page tables or programs. So that's how XV6 like finds the pages, telling the hardware about the memory. XV6 sets the page table base pointer. So the hardware doesn't actually know what memory is allocated or deallocated, it just knows what the page tables are. Does that answer your question? Okay, so then we have shared bus cache coherency. So the shared bus idea is that, you know, simplest way of connecting processors and memory together is one common communication. And you know, advantage is that every processor gets to see all accesses to memory. And we want to have cache coherency, so to keep caches in sync, we have, you know, the want to maintain some invariance. So one of those invariants is that at most one cache, I'll say, has a modified copy of some data. That there's not going to be two cores with a modified copy of some data, because then we get confused about what the current version is. So the key way we ensure this, we have some things. If we have the modified copy, then write it back before anyone tries to read it. Like, we want to make sure that if someone else is trying to read it or write it, read or write it, I should say. We want to make sure that we write it back before anyone tries to read or write it. And we know if someone tries to read or write it, because they will have to ask memory, ask on the bus for a copy. If we want to modify something, then tell everyone, you know, every cache, to get rid of any copy. We know we don't, you know, and that's how we solve that problem. To modify something, copy, and we have an op. So that's like a working proposal. But the problem with this is that, you know, so a problem, we don't want to tell everyone every time we write, because that's slow. So this above is like a minimal working proposal, that if we want to if a modified copy, we write it back before anyone reads or writes it. Whenever you write it, we tell everyone, hey, I'm writing it, get rid of anything you've read. But that's annoying because we don't want to tell everyone every time we write. Usually, they won't have a copy anyways. Anyways, this is a waste. So the solution here is to remember that we've already told everyone to get rid of their copy, and figure out and get their copy. So we know we don't have to tell them proactively. And this remembering, this is the modified state. So the modified state is saying, I already told everyone to get rid of their copy. I don't need to tell them again. Yeah, we're good. And that's sort of the, yeah.
When you say get rid of their copy, that means they set it to invalid. So when they try to read from it again.
Yes, so to get rid of their copy, they set it to invalid. As far as the states go, so in a real cache, you probably won't actually explicitly track the invalid state because you'll put other things in that slot in your cache. Hopefully. Yeah, and so the idea is that we have this modified state, so we track explicitly that, hey, I don't need to tell everyone about every time I write. I just need to tell them, just need to remember that I told them, and then I don't need to tell them again until something changes. And the key idea is that we need to maintain this. What most one cache is a modified copy of the data. It's like what we're maintaining. And with the modified shared invalid protocol, like we have this modified state tells us we are the only one with a shared copy. So we have this optimization that we avoid saying on every write, hey, it changed, make sure you get updated. Which would be is the simplest possible protocol is, hey, is like send every write to everyone. Then you don't have to worry about them being out of sync because we have a shared bus. But that's like just too slow. Next step up. And I think I mentioned briefly there's you might look at this and say, oh, there's like lots of other things that are really not nice, not efficient here, and there's other optimizations beyond this. But it's still all about maintaining this invariant about how the modified copy works, or something like that invariant. We might extend that. We want it to be faster. Yeah.
Yeah. Is this the only transition between states that we don't need to send anything over the bus for?
Is this the only transition between states we don't need to send anything over the bus for? No. So we can always drop something from our cache that isn't modified without telling anyone, for example. And modified to modified isn't a transition, right? Yeah, but there are a bunch, like, we can drop anything from our cache without telling anyone. We can also, like, technically, like, if we modify a value and decide again, if we, like, tell everyone to invalidate their copy, but then decide not to change the value, we could technically just go to shared without telling anyone about it, and that would be safe. So, like, we only need to tell people when we're worried about enforcing our invariants. And in the modified shared invalid protocol, this is the big invariant we need to worry about. I guess there's another invariant which like comes up naturally, which is that when a cache invalidates a modified version, modified copy, it writes it to memory. When a cache, forgets about modified value, it writes it to memory. That's important. So that's the other invariant we want to maintain in this protocol. So I should say before a cache forgets about it, it writes it to memory. So the simplest way is write it immediately, but we want to do better than that. And that's important, otherwise we'll forget the value that's changed. Okay. Questions? Yeah.
Can you trace out the path of a syscall?
So path of a system call. Well, so I'm going to use sort of, so we have some user function to invoke system call. So we have system call wrapper. So this is sort of make it so we can use a C-like or other interface, even though a system call uses a special instruction. So in XV6, this was in U6.8, so we're not going to test on file names in XV6. I just want to give you a concrete example. So if you want to like look at this when you're studying, you can look at that. V6, this is in usys.s. So this just contains the special instruction that we need to run, which we can't use in C. So that's the user part, and also handles setting up for the calling convention ROS has chosen. So in XV6 calling convention, system call calling convention is arguments are on the stack like a normal function call, and EAX says which system call to do. So this system call wrappers runs in user mode, it's responsible for that. Then we have and this is in XV6, so we'll say this is in XV6, so other OSs might differ a little after this point. So we have generic trap handling. So XV6's choice is same code for all exception to handle saving registers, etc. So this gets run next, and this saves user registers. So we don't have to worry about the kernel using those registers itself. Overwriting those values, and also saves what caused the trap for later. And this is in XV6, trap asm.s and traps.c. And then we have the system call dispatcher. So this is based on the trap being a system call, figure out which system call implementation to run. So this is an XV6 is in syscall.c. So XV6 use saved EAX value to look up actual system call implementation. So then we have the system call implementation. This is XV6, this is in sysproc.c and sysfile.c. This is the actual code that implements the particular service requested. So like reading, writing, killing a process, whatever the system call actually is meant to do happens here. This is, needs to retrieve arguments in XV6. You reads from the user stack because convention says arguments are there. and does system call specific operation. So that could vary tremendously depending on what system call is. And then return going backwards from bottom to top. So return from the system call implementation to the system call dispatcher, which does, stores the result. Dispatcher stores result from system call implementation if and generic trap handling goes restores user registers that were saved, and then the wrapper function returns to the function call the application made. Questions? Yeah.
Which of this is actually in kernel mode?
So everything, generic trap handling afterwards, this is all where the kernel mode boundary is. So this is kernel mode starts here, and kernel mode ends here. Okay. And I'm showing a case where, so the system call implementation might do something like wait for something to happen, and that might mean context switching away, but this is that's all just in that system call specific operation. So it might do some things that change back to user mode to in another program, but I'm just saying, sort of minimal, the actual system call parts are this. Okay, other questions? Other topics people would like me to go over in our last 3 minutes? Yeah.
False sharing,
okay. So false sharing is related to this. So false sharing. So the, cache coherency guarantees one cache at a time has modified data. Problem, data is kept in larger blocks and caches than your program accesses. So this means that caches will take turns when accessing any part of the block. So, which implies lower performance if two threads manipulate different parts of the same cache block. So, for example, two adjacent array elements, often in the same cache block. So even though they're independent of each other as far as reading and writing, you'll end up taking turns when you have two cores accessing them with independent caches. Is that what you were looking for?
How does the copy of the resource
look? What do you mean the copy?
How does this solve the issue of the lower performance?
So the typical solution is keep the data further apart. So we have independent data, but it's just not, it's too close together in memory, keep it further apart in memory. So I wouldn't say you have copies, but you typically would just add padding. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Do you go over dupe 2?
Dupe 2, okay, so I have very little time, so dupe 2. Dupe 2 from 2, from now on, so we have a files table, so the process control block has a files table, and we just assign 2 equals db files from. Note that So that's what it does. So this means that now FD2 is the same as FD from, but so if we close from, then that does PCB files from equals null. So that won't change the new FD2. So I think that's what people usually miss about this. So like it's assigning it, but like their pointers closes like just nulls it out. Another dupe2 like won't affect it. But dupe2 something else from dot, so that won't change the FD2. So if we dupe2 something else onto, it doesn't change it. That, I think I'm out of time. So I have office hours tomorrow. Thursday.